Soon there would be another story, one about Morgan shooting his way out of jail, and yet another about him shooting the refrigerator in memory of Hydro, or in honor of Hydro's daddy. As long as there was a story, that's all that really mattered. It didn't have to be true or to make much sense.
Writer Lewis Norden, he'll be back in just a moment with more from his new novel, The Sharpshooter Blues. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Speaking of sharpshooters, later on the show this week, I'll talk with writer John Miller. He'll be here to read from and discuss his new book, Jackson Street and Other Soldier Stories. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Like the music of the Mississippi Delta, which inspires his writing, the fiction of Lewis Norden is rich and complex, by turns playful and serious. As he did in his previous books, Music of the Swamp and Wolf Whistle, in his new novel, Lewis Norden once again takes us to Arrowcatcher, Mississippi, and into the heart of a Gothic American darkness. The Sharpshooter Blues is a meditation on blue steel barrels and snub-nosed bullets, violence and loss. But it's also a story about love and tenderness involving fathers and sons, husbands and wives, gay lovers, longtime neighbors and friends. With an excerpt from The Sharpshooter Blues, here is Lewis Norden.
All the old crowd was there. Gilbert, the house painter, Runt, the grave digger, Mr. Kwong, the butcher, Red, who owned the good-looking Bar and Grow, competitor to William Tell. Wiley Hurd, the one-legged arrow-catching coach. Leonard, of course, at the organ. And Leonard's new friend, Kevin, with iron and steel tattooed on his fists. Families Dr. McNaughton had known all his life. Even Mr. William Tell was there, whom nobody ever saw, who didn't show his face around town or even around his own store for months at a time, years sometimes. Mr. Tell was a tall, goofy-looking man who did Red Skelton impressions.
I went to the crossroads, fell down on my knees.
Buddy, what happens in Arrowcatcher, Mississippi, in this novel?
Well, on a certain day, Hydro Rainey, a simple-minded boy who is keeping a country store called the William Tell Grocery, is visited by a couple of desperate criminals whom he always thinks of as the lovely children for some unknown reason. And they attempt a robbery, and Hydro ends up killing them. And that is the event that begins the novel, in effect, and begins a chain of events from which Hydro doesn't ever quite recover.
Right. Tell me about Morgan, the sharpshooter. How does he figure into this?
Morgan is a tiny, displaced little guy who has been living for a while on a ranch in Texas. He was a foundling who was found actually in the bulrushes of the swamp by a voodoo woman.
Right.
And
That's Aunt Lily.
That's Aunt Lily, right. And in fact, I had an Aunt Lily when I was a child in Mississippi, and maybe I felt that I had been found in a canebrake too, but... In any case, Morgan has tried to find a world of his own, as all these characters are looking for, in which he can reside comfortably. And he has done it by learning to sharpshoot a pistol. Mm-hmm. He's a trick shot, and it's he who is blamed for the killing at the grocery store.
What about, you got a character named the Prince of Darkness. Now, the tongue is in the cheek, I guess, and at the same time, we got something serious going on here. Tell me about the Prince of Darkness in this book.
The Prince of Darkness is one of my favorite people. He's developed in my mind and in my fiction over a period of time. He's the funeral director in Arrowcatcher, Mississippi. And he is a man who lives alone and alienated. He lived with his mother for a long time, who had a pipe organ in their small apartment in the funeral home.
Right.
And of all the people on earth who seem most alienated, it's he. In fact, there's a strong rumor that his mother has perpetrated that he is a zombie, that he has actually been brought back from the dead.
Well, you got the sharpshooter's mother is a voodoo witch.
Yes. Well, this doesn't turn out to be true, as the Prince of Darkness later explains. But to tell the truth, the Prince of Darkness is based on a character, not a character, a real person whom I knew in West Virginia, who was also a funeral director, who was called the Prince of Darkness. The people who knew him called him that at parties or anywhere else. I never learned his real name.
Now, to come back to some of the serious themes here, suicide, alcoholism, death, destruction, yet all of this exists inside a novel that ends on a wonderfully tender and affirmative note. How do you work to pull that off?
Well, again, like everything else in my fiction, these elements are a part of my own life. I was on a panel one time with a lot of other writers, and the topic of the panel was the Southern family. And I had to say, I did not really know about the Southern family. I knew about the family afflicted with alcoholism and suicide and dysfunction and of various types, and that was the family I could talk about. Whether it was specifically Southern, I was not sure.
Uh-huh.
Now, my family has suffered all these problems, and I have come out of it a joyful and hopeful person. So it's necessary, I think, for me to write such a book, that my book would end on a high note, which is really at a funeral wake, as it turns out.
That's right.
And so I think this is just another reflection of my own life.
You make me think of the scene at the beginning of this wake, at the beginning of this funeral that ends your book, a conversation between one of the characters, the doctor in Arrowcatcher, Mississippi. His name is Dr. McNaughton, and his son, Lewis. And what they're talking about is what it means to be normal. And the kid finally has an opportunity to say to his daddy, am I a geek? And what's normal? Tell me about that scene and how that goes to this issue you were just describing of being a member of a family.
Yes, little Lewis McNaughton has always felt a little geeky, a little different from everybody else. He wears some kind of dumb-looking little pink-rimmed glasses. He feels different and alienated and separate from everyone else. His life is tied up largely in comic books and in his love for his little sister. He has felt so little affection in his family. His mother's alcoholic. His father's a very distant, strange guy who watches television all the time. And so this conversation that they're having is a turning point in their whole family's life. This is the first time they've ever talked. The topic of the conversation is not so important as the fact that they're having the conversation, but the topic of it is the same thing that I think I'm asking myself and that we're all asking. How do I fit in? What is my place in this world?
Right. Now, Lewis has a little sister. Again, her name is Katie, and the mama's name is Ruth. She's the one who's having the love affair with the sharpshooter. You have all these characters who move in and around this orbit of the sharpshooter. He's in the book, and yet he's not in the book. I mean, he's not that much of an organizing presence. Tell me about that.
Yes, the sharpshooter is in some ways less of a character in the book than most of the other characters. Mm-hmm. This is in large degree a book about Hydro and his father, although there are a great many other characters, and some of them come on stage at significant times. The sharpshooter is, in a way, the Moby Dick of this book. He's a character who looms large in everyone's life.
And yet he's a little guy to begin with.
Yes, and yet he's a tiny Moby Dick,
right?
If there ever was one.
Buddy, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. What exactly are the sharpshooter blues? What is it that Morgan, the sharpshooter, and all these characters are working their way through as we read your new novel?
The Sharpshooter Blues as a title came to me late in the process. I had originally thought to call it just The Sharpshooter. But the idea of this being a sad song and yet a celebration in song of the unhappiness of these lives struck me as a very good idea just before the book went to publication. The blues is very important to me in my life and in my work. I play harmonica along with blues bands when I can, and I have a nice collection of blues music. Robert Johnson is a big favorite of mine. He's always showing up in books. But the truth is, I think that the blues celebrates sadness so that that sadness becomes something beautiful. And that's what I do in this book, I hope. I hope I make the tragedy of these lives funny and beautiful and ironic and all the things that I believe blues music does for me.
Is it fair to say that by creating such comically unhappy situations and characters as you have in Wolf Whistle and the Sharpshooter Blues that you're making yourself happy?
Oh, I do make myself happy. I have to say I'm my best fan. And my wife claims that when I'm at the computer that I might someday die in my own arms. yes, it makes me very happy to write out these strange characters' lives.
Lewis Norden is the author of The Sharpshooter Blues, available from Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Lewis Norden's other books include Music of the Swamp and Wolf Whistle, named one of the top 15 books of the last 15 years by the Bloomsbury Review. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Apropos of sharpshooters, stay tuned for writer John Miller. John Miller will be here in just a moment to read from and talk about his new book, Jackson Street and Other Soldier Stories. Before that, however, here again is Lewis Norden with another excerpt from The Sharpshooter Blues.
Morgan looked at him. He said, "I ain't really Mexican. I wouldn't want to tell no more lies." That was what he said, and it was true enough. He was through with lies. What he was really thinking, though, was that for all the trouble he might have caused, for all the danger he had put people in today, there was something to be proud of here as well. A good thing he had done, if you looked at it in just the right way. Morgan looked over at the child, poor, bewildered, hopeful Lewis, standing there at the door, in the confusion and cordite, trying to undo his lie, untell his tale. And Morgan thought of what Lewis would never know, that by Morgan's choice of life over death, not drilling the big white slow-moving target of Weber Chisholm's innocent chest, and not putting the pistol barrel into his own mouth and tasting the gun oil and the fire, he had given Lewis, and maybe the whole world, the rare gift of effective moral damage control. A lie without consequences, or at least not the consequences of the rules of contagious despair, as they are usually practiced on this earth. By this choice of life, Lewis had been set free. There were details to iron out. Firing the gun was a crime, of course. Taking it from the marshal was a crime, maybe even attempted escape. Other decisions would have to be made, choices with their own meaning, their own consequences. For now, these could wait. Everyone was only glad to be alive, to hear words of truth, sad at the thought of Hydro's passing out of this life.
I got stones in my pathway, and my road seemed dark at night. I got stones in my pathway, and my road seemed dark at night.
I put it off as long as I could, going over to see Mary Alice. Finally, I went over the evening before I had to report to the Army. She was sitting at the kitchen table when I knocked on the back door. It had been a terribly hot day, hot and humid, and a fan was struggling to move the heavy air around the kitchen. "I joined the Army," I said. "I'm leaving in the morning." The labored hum of the fan seemed to fill the small room. I hesitated for a moment, not sure what to say next. Through an open window, to the west toward Raleigh, I could see lightning. "It's fixin' to rain tonight," I said. Mary Alice rose and walked silently from the kitchen. After a minute or two, I got up and let myself out the back door. The sky had darkened considerably, and the air was heavy with the smell of ozone.
Writer John Miller. His new book is Jackson Street and Other Soldier Stories. Drawing on his own experience in the military, John Miller adds to the tradition of fiction about young men and women finding ways out of small southern towns that their parents struggled to survive. In Jackson Street and Other Soldier Stories, John Miller brings us face to face with uncelebrated heroes and heroines. In surprising and unexpected ways, he measures the impact of the military on individuals and families. At the same time, he explores America's unresolved Vietnam legacy. With an excerpt from Jackson Street and other soldier stories, here is John Miller.
When Henry Teeter first arrived in Santa Monica, the only thing he wanted to do was sit on the seawall at the very end of Wilshire Boulevard and watch the sunset. At several times during his pilgrimage, he thought he might never get to the West Coast, and so once there he was content merely to sit quietly for a time. After 7 days of heading due west from North Carolina, he had turned south at Needles on the advice of a filling station attendant, who thought that Henry's old Chevrolet might have an easier go of it approaching the Pacific coast from the southeast. From Blythe to Brawley, he skirted the Chocolate Mountains and kept a weather eye on the Chevy's temperature gauge. At Salton City, he stopped to ponder the prehistoric Salton Sea and encountered an Airstream encampment of ancient Germans turning nut brown in a wasteland as far removed from the Schwarzwald as the dark side of the moon. "You are a soldier, ja?" one of the old men asked him. Henry smiled and nodded. "Used to be," he said. "You are welcome to stay and have dinner with us," the old man said. In the distance, the low cliffs of the Orocopia Mountains hung over the brackish water of the Salton Sea like a beetling, pithocene brow. The old man swept his arm in a wide arc encompassing the entire group. "We have all come here to die in the sun."
John, welcome to the National Humanities Center.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Let's talk about some of the themes and characters in your book, Jackson Street and Other Soldier Stories. You've got one story here called Guns. We have a man named Henry Teeter, and I suppose it wouldn't be unfair to you or the story to say that this is not a story with a happy ending. Here's a man who just basically dies on the beach after getting out of the Army. He's out in Santa Monica. Is it that bleak? I mean, my goodness, that we put this at the head end of the collection?
Well, actually, I don't view it quite so bleakly. I think that in many ways the story has a bright lining and a good story to tell. In many ways, of course, it is sad. Henry Teeter comes out of the military with a terminal illness. It's not described, presumably cancer, and knows he's going to die. But before he does so, he wants to come out to California. He's never been there, although he's spent some 20-odd years in the Army. Mm-hmm. And he wants to die on the West Coast and does so, comes out alone. I think the story points out, or at least was intended to describe, the fact that for many people whose lives are centered around the military, for the lifers, if you will,
right,
it is in many ways a very lonely experience. Living in the barracks, there's much less of an opportunity to have a wife and a family. And many of the people that I knew in the Army that were career soldiers, career NCOs in particular, struck me as being very lonely.
Well, I don't mean to sound melodramatic or hokey here, but, you know, this man simply wants to look and sit and look at the ocean and watch the sun, and that for him is a sort of restorative and curative kind of experience.
It is. It gives him an opportunity to look back on his life. He was never a particularly contemplative man while he was young and alive.
Mm-hmm.
And had the big guns, as the story describes. Guns, of course, is a euphemism that arose in the bodybuilding culture of Venice Beach in California. It's a euphemism for the biceps.
Right.
Somebody that has big arms has the big guns. And so when Henry had the big guns as a young man, he didn't spend a great deal of his life thinking about his life, and as many of us don't. And when he realized that the end was near, all he wanted to do, as the story relates, is sit on the beach and try to come to terms with himself, try to see where he has fit into the overall scheme of things.
Let's bring your collection of stories, John, closer to home, that meaning North Carolina. You've got one story called Jackson Street. Here we learn about Mary Alice Goodman and a man named Virgil Green, quintessential Southern name there. What happens to Mary Alice and Virgil?
Well, Mary Alice is the small-town piano teacher, and I wanted to write a story that dealt with small-town lives, and the difficulty in smaller towns for many people to make a connection, to find a mate, if you will, to find somebody to fall in love with, and particularly once you get past a certain point in your life. So Mary Alice is the piano teacher in town, and the story is told through the eyes and voice of a younger man who is sort of a teenage handyman that helped around Mary Alice's house, and not surprisingly, fell in love with her himself.
Right, and he's big buddies with Virgil.
Virgil is his cousin. Virgil is
the hero.
And his hero. Virgil is sort of the quintessential bad boy who several years older than the narrator, who gets into trouble, leaves town in the dead of night, and the narrator misses him a great deal thereafter. Comes back to town and immediately focuses on Mary Alice, and not surprisingly, the two of them are drawn to each other.
Now, why is this a military story? I mean,
well,
what
it's,
is it that,
the only real connection here, of course, is the fact that the narrator at the time of the story is now 17 or 18 years old, and as was the case in that time in the South, was going to go into the military one way or the other as soon as he got out of high school, either by joining it or by being drafted. Also, Virgil is a veteran, and a veteran with a clouded past, shall we say, that made him even more romantic. when he comes back to town, of course, and it's a small town, as I said, many stories crop up about Virgil, and not being willing to comment on them, of course, as I note in the story, he merely confirms them all by his silence, and so becomes something of a even greater hero for the young narrator.
Let's talk about how the military in your fiction, John Miller, acts on families. That is a theme that runs through many of these stories. I'm thinking, for example, of one called Blackstone. We have Danny and his mom. The mom is getting ready to drop the grandpa off at the Baptist home, and she gets involved with a sort of military lowlife by the name of Billy Murdoch. Tell me about this.
Here again, I think it's a case of essentially good people who make bad choices. She's a young woman with a young boy and no husband, no man about, as the ne'er-do-well Billy Murdoch puts it. And she's a young woman and she's lonely. She's got big problems. She's got a father that she's got to put into a retirement home. She doesn't have a job. She's trapped. And this is in the mid to late 1950s. And there were not many options open to young women in those years.
Well, does she fall victim here because, the frailties, the messiness of human nature, or does it, again, go to a sort of military proposition? Has the Army, in effect, educated this guy, Billy, to become the predator?
I think not. I think I see Billy as, and again, I don't see Billy as quite as bleak a character either. He is certainly somebody who is without as many redeeming values as we would like to see, perhaps.
Well, he has a sort of comic dimension to
it. He does. He's a drifter. He's in the Army. He doesn't know where he's going. He doesn't really care where he's going. In this particular story, he goes AWOL, as a matter of fact, and steals a car and ends up at this little trailer court in a small Virginia town. And as luck would have it, there's an opportunity. So he and the young woman are attracted to each other. They're both young people. Mm-hmm. It is an inconvenience, of course, that she has a young boy with her. Neither of them really abuse the young boy. They certainly abuse him in the sense that he's ignored, that he's left by himself when, of course, he shouldn't be. And here's where the main character in this story, besides the little boy, comes in, the old man.
This would be Mr. Gates.
Vernon Gates, who built the tourist court and has lived there all his life and has little of interest in his life now. He's getting near the end of his life. His wife is dead. He has no children.
So this is a kind of father-son story, but it's a generational kind of thing.
It is.
We have to move back past the nominal daddy and at that age onto this older man.
And he sees what's going on between the mother and the young soldier, and the young boy is drawn to him inexorably, of course.
So you're writing about male responsibility, after a fashion.
I think so. I think in this case, the old man and the boy reaching out and touching each other, two people without an anchor in their lives, shall we say. And the story ends on a sad note, of course, but I think a very realistic one, and that is that again, people perhaps at best in their lives can hope only to make momentary connections, to have a small amount of insight before the end, and that in most cases is probably enough. It probably has to be enough.
John Miller is the author of Jackson Street and Other Soldier Stories, available from Orloff Press. John Miller's fiction has also appeared in the Missouri Review, Cross Currents, and the William and Mary Review. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for a cassette tape of this program. Before that, however, with another excerpt from Jackson Street and Other Soldier Stories, here again is John Miller.
He leaned onto the stand and placed the Marlin stock against his right cheek. The sharp, sweet smell of solvent and linseed oil rose from the weapon and evoked an almost hallucinatory image in his mind of young men firing automatic weapons into dense undergrowth, the ejected cartridges whirring through the air like startled birds flushed from underfoot. Squinting through the scope, he saw the fresh targets. Behind him, both Eugene and Floyd observed the targets through binoculars. Bill relaxed his shoulders, held his breath, and squeezed the trigger. A hole appeared in the target, an inch left and 2 inches high of the bullseye. Bill stared through the scope for a second and levered a fresh round into the chamber. Again he relaxed, stilled his breathing, and fired. A second hole appeared, just touching the first. He closed both eyes and inhaled deeply, his mouth slightly open, tasting the aroma of the smokeless powder on his lips and tongue. Floyd and Eugene watched silently as Bill straightened up and made a small adjustment to the scope's settings. Taking the rifle up once again, he snugged it onto his cheek and settled the crosshairs on the target. Lost completely in ritual, he fired the remaining 3 rounds in the rifle's magazine without conscious thought. He knew without looking, even as he knew his own name, that all 3 bullets had pierced the target's bullseye. An aching sadness settled over his shoulders as he stared downrange through the rifle's scope, his life reduced, it seemed, to mere holes in a paper target. "I feel like an old man," he thought. "An old man, and I don't know why." He laid the rifle on the stand and began to cry, tears rolling off his cheeks and onto the Marlin's walnut stock.
Paranoia strikes deep. Into your life it will creep.
It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guests this week were writers Lewis Norden and John Miller. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Audio tapes of this program are available for $10 postpaid. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. When you write, please ask for program number 812. That's $10, program number 812. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Next week on Soundings, Disciplines, an overview of the humanities and the social sciences in contemporary American education. Join me for conversations featuring 3 prominent commentators, historian and former Williams College president Francis Oakley, anthropologist Nancy Shepherd Hughes of the University of California at Berkeley, and Robert Connor, director of the National Humanities Center. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.